This is HPR episode 2403 entitled Amateur Radio Roundtable #3 and is part of the series HAM Radio QSK. It is hosted by various hosts and is about 59 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is: two guys try to answer Ken's questions about ham radio.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to Hacker Public Radio, and this is the Amateur Radio Roundtable number 3. Today we have myself, Steve, KD0IJP, we have Michael, DL4MGM, and we have our very own Ken Fallon with us today. Also...
Unlicensed.
Ken's call is N0CALL, no call. And we may also have Russ K5TUX joining us here too after a little bit, and maybe some others as well. So welcome everybody.
Thanks guys for putting this on.
Hello everybody, and I think Ken will qualify as SWL, a shortwave listener.
All right, there you go. All right, so we did not really have any topics queued up for this episode. So not exactly sure where to start, but
well, let me just jump right in there and ask you a few questions.
Excellent, that's what you're here for. Go ahead and do so.
Random stuff out of the top of my head in the US, for, well, from the point of view of Hacker Public Radio, we're assuming that people are getting that Bofang, little Bofang radio, and then we're going to try and have the people do the entry level exam. Here in the Netherlands, you need to do a sort of technical piece of work. In the US or in the UK, you need to show proficiency on a soldering board. What are the requirements for entry level in the US or where you guys are?
All right. Well, for the US, I can probably speak to that. Really, the only thing you have to do is you have to pass the test. The test is... let's see, I guess the test questions are generated in conjunction with the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission. You have to pass that test, and that test is just simply a multiple choice thing. The entire pool of questions are available, and they just take a subset of that pool and give you the test. And there's three levels of tests. There's, we call them the technician, the general class, and the extra class. That test is made up of questions related to some technical things like electronics. It includes some operation stuff, some rules, and just that basic stuff like that. But once you've passed that test, you get your call sign, and you're ready to go. There's no other... requirements really whatsoever. The only thing is, you know, with the beginning level, the technician class, you have a relatively limited number of frequencies that you can transmit on. If you want more privileges, you have to get the higher level test, which again is just another multiple choice test. But there's no soldering proficiency. We used to have a requirement for Morse code, but that's no longer the case. So it's pretty simple. Someone else?
Yeah, the same here in Germany. You just have to do the paperwork and in theory, know about the electronic stuff and so on. But no one is asking you to do some practical demonstration or a test. You do not need to know where the hot end of the soldering iron is, so to speak.
Okay, very good. if you're ever stuck for topics to discuss on this roundtable, good idea might be to go over to the US tests, because I think most other countries are kind of based around those. It's been running the longest. And take some sample questions, and so people here would get a feel for the level of technical proficiency in order to jump right in. Because I think here the goal is, if we can get anybody to get a novice license or I think was a technician license in the US.
That's what the entry level is called now. It used to be called novice, but it's now called technician.
Yeah. So here it's the novice one. So if we can get people to get the novice licenses, then, you know, we can take it from that up to the more advanced stuff, and people can dip their toes in and they won't get prosecuted for operating a radio so long as they operate it within their bands that they're allocated. And then once they're bitten by the bug, then they can proceed on to get the more advanced licenses and stuff.
Hey, related to that, Ken, one time on some show, I think you mentioned that where you're at, it's actually illegal to own an amateur radio until you have the license. Is that correct?
Well, I rechecked that, and it is now not illegal to own it. It is illegal. You have to keep the radio and battery in two separate places. So you can't have an assembled unit if you're not licensed. They have a special license if you're maintaining or repairing radios. I should get a case, one of the amateur radio enthusiasts in Merck, to explain this. But I'll give you a taster now. He used to repair radios, and also outside his class, and military grade, old military World War II radios and stuff like that. And he had a special license in order to be able to use those. But now you can have it physically in your house, but you can't have it connected. You can't turn it on, and they do listen and prosecute people who operate without a license.
Well, but. So you can't even listen in, even if you don't transmit?
That's from what I understand, that is correct. You're not allowed. You can go and buy a shortwave radio all you want, and you can listen to the, online, there's a Drenthe, down in Drenthe, there's a
BEP SDR.
That's the bunny, yeah. And you can listen to all those radio frequencies as long as your heart's content, but you're not allowed to operate a radio that's capable of transmitting.
Okay, well, over here in the US, you're obviously not allowed to transmit, but I don't know of any rules that say that you can't have a radio and listen as much as you want, as far as I know.
I'm not sure if the regulations have changed or if they're just handling it more loosely these days, but in old days, we're not allowed to even activate or operate a transmitter if you were not licensed. And if you bought some surplus equipment at some dealers, they would cut the inner wiring harness unless you prove them by sending in your amateur radio license that you are entitled to own these equipment.
Yeah. So it's coming from that sort of thing. I'll get Case on one time. I'll interview him on the, and says he promising himself a show. But that would be interesting, just to go over the licensing peculiarities of the Netherlands here. But I do have a question related to capacitors and coils, inductors.
Inductors, yeah.
So that's like the basis of all radios, capacitors and inductors, yeah. Low pass, high pass filters.
If you're talking about the discrete component analog radio, if you don't have capacitors and inductors, you're not going to have much of a radio.
Okay, so what's the purpose of this? So how does radio work? Very okay. Broad question, I guess.
Okay, I'm going to let Michael take that one.
Okay, let's try to figure this out. So first, yep.
Now, I just, right, what I could not understand for the longest time. I just can't envisage in my head the concept that in the, we're talking about the electromagnetic spectrum here. Yes. So basically visible light. Well, visible in the same spectrum that visible light is in. Yes. Correct or not?
Yes, that is generally considered the way it is, sure.
Okay, that doesn't sound like yes, Ken. That's 100% correct there.
Well, I think it's 100% correct. I mean, it is kind of hard to visualize. I'll agree with that. When that electromagnetic spectrum gets to a certain frequency, it suddenly becomes visible light. I agree, is kind of hard to fathom. But yes, that is the case. It is all one electromagnetic spectrum. In the lower frequencies of that, we have RF stuff. You get higher, you get into infrared, you get into visible, and so on.
Okay, so the way I was, now I've been thinking about this for quite a while. So we've got these two radio detectors in our heads, and most people's work, and they're called eyes. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. So at any given time, there's all this light, infrared, microwave, shortwave, longwave stuff broadcasting in the ether, and it's all happening at the same time. Correct?
I would say that is correct. I mean, if you could actually visibly see the lower frequencies as well, like the, you know, the radio waves, RF waves, I'm not sure what that would look like. I think it would just be a blinding ball of light if you could see all that.
Well, now then we get into the whole concept of color, especially RGBs, because in those cases, the function of the eye, for those of us who can see and those of us who can see color, each of the three corneas are basically high and low pass filtering out a particular bandwidth of that spectrum. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. That sounds right. Yes.
So basically, we're all ham radio operators.
Exactly. Whether you want to be or not.
If there are ham bands in that visible spectrum.
And you are licensed to use it. Correct. Valid, thank you very much.
Valid point.
So essentially, there's all this stuff going on, and it's all happening at the same time, but it doesn't seem to interfere with the other things that's going on. So that's kind of where I was. That's where I am now in my journey of trying to get my head around this, that in the same way that you can see red and green and blue at the same time, you can have something on 2 meters, something on 10 meters, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's why you need front end filtering to filter out all the other stuff, which might overload your receiver, and to get to the signals you want to hear and to receive and to mix or convert them down to something that we as humans can accept.
Okay, so the analogy then the whole audio wavelengths and stuff, we use the same sort of terminology, correct? But that's completely different. That's a different medium entirely.
You're saying with audio? Yeah, audio is really more about air compression and vibrations, air vibrations affecting your eardrum.
So the confusing thing, I guess, for me was that if you have somebody talking on a ham radio, they're actually sending a signal over the light spectrum, and then that your radio device converts that from the light spectrum to the audio, to the, you know, it compresses the airwaves so that you can hear it.
If you exchange light spectrum by electromagnetic spectrum, sorry, then, yes, then that's what I mean. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, electromagnetic. Sorry. Thank you. Well done, you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, you know, there's been, I've heard this before, like at if you're at a concert, for example, and you're sitting, you know, halfway back in the audience, and right up next to the stage, there is a microphone connected to a radio that's going, you know, clear across the country, and somebody's listening to a receiver, and they're sitting next to that receiver. They're actually hearing the sound before you do, even though they're thousands of miles away, because of the speed difference between sound and electromagnetic.
Okay, I won't confuse that debate now with buffering on MPEG packets and stuff. So, but yes, back in the day, I guess.
Sure, yes, sure.
Assuming analog transmission.
Exactly. Okay, that I think has cleared it up for me. So now we have all this stuff floating around in the... and it all seems to coexist and nothing seems to interfere with nothing else for the most part. Are there interferences where wavelengths are multiples of each other? Does that cause interference? Say 2 meters, 4 meters, whatever.
Yeah, depend. It depends.
Is that like what the harmonics are about?
Yes. So some of the amateur radio shortwave bands are located at harmonic relations. So say 80 meters is 3.5 megahertz, 40 meters is 7 megahertz, and so on. I think this was on purpose to have most of the harmonics of the amateur radio transmissions within our own bands. And
so can you explain very quickly what harmonics is for us? Just people might not know. And why they deliberately did that, why it's a why we would be keeping the crud in the amateur radio bands.
Yeah, okay. So harmonics are just basically multiples of your transmit frequency. Say you're transmitting a carrier wave at 3.5 megahertz, and if you have an ideal transmitter, it will transmit this one carrier wave and nothing else. But real transmitters produce a certain amount of harmonics, so you will have some energy at 7 megahertz, at 10.5 megahertz, and so on. Of course, there are regulations saying that your harmonic content has to be a certain level below your transmitter output, and so on, but every real transmitter has some sort of some amount of those emissions too. And you,
so what causes the harmonic in the first place?
Non-linearities in components. So at every non-linear characteristic of some component in the in the signal path, you will create harmonics or mixed signals and so on.
Okay, so what does non-linear mean in this case?
Yeah, for example, if you increase the input signal in an amplifier or something else, and you by a certain amplification, you increase the output signal, and it's always the same relation. There's no change. For example, if you overdrive an amplifier, you increase the input signal, but the output signal can't go any higher because it reached the limit of the amplifier, or at least the amplification factor is going down. So you will have some sort of compression of the output signal, and this is a non-linearity. And that's why you hear, also in audio, you will hear harmonics in an audio signal if you overdrive an audio amplifier, like a microphone amplifier, or what are those distorters called?
Compressors or something? I don't know.
Yeah, not compressors, but so those effect generators where you deliberately overdrive an amplifier to get certain sound effects.
Okay, yeah.
On electric guitars, and that's where you use these effects to get an audio modification. And if you do this with an RF amplifier, it will produce lots of harmonic energy, and that's normally not what you want to be output to your antenna.
And a lot of this is happening in one of the stages in radio modulation involves mixers. You're doing a lot of mixing of different frequencies, and it's just sort of a side effect of that, due to non-linearity and probably some other things. I'm not an expert in this, but it's just sort of a side effect of the electronic manipulations that are going on with the signal.
But you can put it to good use, for example, in frequency multipliers, where you produce deliberately those harmonics and then use a filter to select the higher harmonic you want to use. And voila, you have multiplied your frequency by that factor in between.
Okay, a more in-depth show on that would be called for, I think, I think that's more advanced. So these things happen, what do we call them? Harmonics happen at a particular space that's predictable. That's just a feature of them, is it?
Yes, yes.
And then they've divided the ham radio bands up so that those on the lower bands will appear on the higher ham radio bands and not squashing somebody else's ham radio band.
Well, I mean, the ideal thing is that if you have a, you know, well-made radio, there's going to be some filtering involved such that, you know, the energy outside of what you're really trying to transmit gets taken down to a negligible amount. I think, though, you know, there's a recognition that in amateur radio, part of the whole, you know, DNA of amateur radio is experimentation. And so, you know, people that are going to build their own equipment or whatever might not do a very good job of that. And so, you know, if you have that spurious emissions also landing on amateur bands, it's not going to cause as much interference with other things that are maybe more important.
But that's exactly the reason why we need those tests, and that you are aware of those regulations, what you have to fulfill, that you know the technical background to construct or to build a correctly working transmitter. And that's why we are given this privilege to build transmitter on our own, because we are the only radio service that is allowed to have their own equipment without certification by some government organization or so.
Okay, but then when you say that, that's great, I get it. But somebody's thinking, well, if I'm going to be allowed to build, if somebody in my license is allowed to build a radio, then there's going to be an awful lot of, that's going to be a really tough exam to do. So are there restrictions on the types of radios that a novice can do or not?
Not in Germany.
Yeah, no, not explicitly. I mean, you're correct. You are being able to pass the test does not in any way mean that you know enough to, you know, really build a radio from scratch and have it work properly. I mean, that it's just, there's way more to it than that. The idea, I think, is that if you pass that test, you understand the general issues, and so hopefully you are maybe a little more careful if you go into doing your own construction and that kind of thing. And I mean, building a radio from scratch is a pretty big deal. Not that many people actually do that. It's more a matter of, you know, kits. There's kits available and various things, and a lot of times they're pretty low power on purpose because of this issue.
I get it, yeah.
But, you know, the other thing to mention is, you mentioned the Baofeng radio earlier, and, you know, the Baofeng radio is a cheap Chinese radio, and it gets knocked quite a bit by a lot of people because they don't do a very good job of filtering either. And there's a lot of people that are really against those cheap Chinese radios because they do produce emissions that are outside of what is really legally allowed. And so it's one thing just to kind of be aware of, if you do buy those cheap radios, they're not the best radios.
No, that's fair enough. For $75, I wasn't expecting a lot. But what it will do is allow me to listen if necessary. And if the country suddenly decides to flood, then I can put the battery in and contact somebody. Guys, remember me?
Yeah, sure. But, you know, as we're talking about this issue, there, you know, the whole issue of filtering and stuff is important on both ends of the, both on the transmitter side and on the receiver side. On the transmitter side, it's important so that you're not sending out, you know, a bunch of spurious energy that you don't intend to. But on the receiving side, it's equally important to have good filtering so that you are eliminating external signals that might interfere. And if you have a strong signal coming in, it could overwhelm the signal that you're trying to listen to. And so filtering is a huge, huge deal on both ends of the radio.
Yeah, and as we already explained, at nonlinearities, not only harmonics can be generated, but also multiple incoming signals can be mixed, and then you get multiples of the difference of some signals or different frequencies if you subtract or add up signals, and if you have multiple signals, this can be quite a mess.
Okay, if I can leave that one there for a minute and then go back to some basic fundamentals again. If in our hypothetical analog radio back in the day when there's nobody, no regulations or whatever, and we're building that, the basic principle of a radio is this whole concept of resonant frequency. Yeah. Now, can you talk to me about that? Because I have an analogy, I think, that may or may not work, and I want to hit you with it. But the whole concept of resonant frequency, as far as I understand it, is core to every radio, correct or not?
Yeah, sure. If you take a resonant circuit, for example, a parallel resonant circuit with a capacitor and a coil, and you have an electromagnetic an electromagnetic wave, energy from the coil going to the capacitor and reverse. So, for example, you charge up the capacitor, then you have a potential voltage across this capacitor. This voltage across the coil, which is basically just a wire, causes a current to flow, which will build up a magnetic field around the coil.
Yeah.
And the capacitor will discharge until the point where you have the maximum current flow, and then the voltage will go down and the magnetic field will collapse, inducing a voltage into the coil itself, which will charge up the capacitor. So the energy will travel from the capacitor to the coil, from the coil to the capacitor, and so on.
Until it filters out.
Yes. Because you have losses in the circuit, it will be reduced in amplitude, and suddenly taper down and vanish.
So it's a bit like a seesaw, I guess, where one side is a vacuum pump, and the other side is a spring. So you sit on the spring, it pulls up a vacuum, a pump, bicycle pump, for instance, and then that gets strong enough, the vacuum sucks it back down, creating energy in the spring, and vice versa, flip-flop, over and back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's...
Not a great analogy.
Well, it's not a bad analogy, but when you start talking about resonance, the issue is that by adjusting the values of, say, the capacitor and the inductor, or in your case, adjusting the values that represent the physical characteristics of the spring and the vacuum and so on, there's a certain frequency at which if this back and forth is happening at a frequency that is tuned to the values of those devices, this action has a tendency to go on much longer, and even to a certain extent amplify itself, because they're working together at exactly the right frequency, the right rate to tend to propel this action on. And that's really what resonance is about.
Okay, now, I always remember when I was in the reserve, when you walk across a bridge, you were told to break marching so that you wouldn't cause resonant frequency in a bridge. And if you ever walk across a rope bridge and you're walking at a particular pace, you feel that in your foot coming back up. Is that, from a mechanical engineering point of view, that's resonant frequency? Is that the same sort of concept?
Sure, that's exactly right.
Okay, now, taking it to the next level. I have a trampoline in my back garden, and I grab one of my children, and I have them bounce on the trampoline. And they're bouncing up and down at a frequency of, say, one bounce per second. Yeah? And they're getting maybe, I don't know, half their height up. Or they're getting, a quarter of their height up every bounce. However, if I hold their hands and bounce them up so that when the bottom of the trampoline is down and they hit it just at that right point, they go higher and higher and higher. Is that like amplification of the resonant?
Right. That's exactly right. What you're doing is you're adjusting the frequency of their jump to match the resonant frequency of the trampoline. And so when you hit that resonance, you get a much bigger effect.
So that is the wavelength is coming in all in the what do we call it, electromagnetic spectrum. And because you're hitting the resonant frequency of this component that you built, you're amplifying it and therefore able to detect it.
That's right. And that, I mean, that's what we're really talking about in the radio spectrum is we're talking about antennas, quite frankly, because when you send out a signal on a certain frequency to an antenna, if that antenna is resonant on that frequency, you're going to get the radiation of that energy at a much more efficient level. If it's not resonant, then a lot of that energy you send to the antenna is actually going to bounce right back to the radio and is not going to propagate like you want. So resonance becomes a huge issue when you start talking about antennas.
And that's just for transmission, but is the same true for reception?
The same is true for reception. If your antenna is resonant on the frequency you're trying to hear, you will get a much better reception. It's not as critical, though, in reception as far as like damaging the radio. When you're transmitting, if you're transmitting to an antenna that is not properly tuned, you will get energy that comes back, and it'll be strong enough that it could damage the radio. That's not going to happen for receiving. But yes, receiving, it is important in terms of being able to hear a good signal.
Okay, so you're bouncing this child up, and then all of a sudden it goes completely wonky and the child goes smashing back into you, I guess. Would be a bad analogy, but fine, I get your point. Which is why you need tuned antennas and all the rest, I guess.
Yep, that's basically it. Do you agree with what I'm saying, Mike?
Yeah, basically.
Sorry, all these questions may seem very, very strange to you guys, but these are the ones that have been blocking me in my whole understanding of what the hell is going on here, because it's not enough for me personally, and everybody else may be different, but I need to kind of visualize what's going on in my head to get the concept itself.
Yeah, it's all fine. That's why we're here.
Okay, now, I've got a garden, right? And I've got a length of hose. And if I have that hose and I wiggle that hose up and down with one of the kids, and I make one wave that goes 2 meters, that's a 2 meter wavelength. That is essentially the actual physical wavelength of this thing that's coming into the radio. Is that correct?
If the length of the hose is your propagation medium and then the wavelength across this medium, yes.
So if I had a 2 meter piece of wire, then the wavelength that's coming in has to be 2 meters. Or is it not the 2 meters, or where is it? Is it the transversing of the sine wave, or is it does it all hit at the one time? This is something else I don't understand.
No, so if you have a 2 meter wavelength in air or vacuum or something, and you have a 2 meter wire, then you have a full wavelength antenna, radio, whatever you would call it. So you can use this if you couple the signal correctly to this 2 meter wire. You can use this as a transmit or a receive antenna, but you can also use half wave antennas, quarter wave antennas.
Okay, getting too complicated. But we're talking about on the 2 meter band, we're building a simple radio, a theoretical radio with no tuning or anything. It's just going to be tuned to one frequency. Frequency is 2 meters. So the wavelength coming in, if I've got a 2 meter piece of wire and I have my kids wobble a pipe and that the wavelength of the pipe is 2 meters, then once I stand over that wire, at some point, there's only one piece of the wavelength hitting that wire at any one time. So how is this possible? Do you get what I mean? Wavelength is a piece of wire that's a vertical thing that's 2 meters long, yeah? But a wave is not actually a physical object. It describes the movement of a thing. So yeah. Just like the waves on the sea, you draw them as a kid, which is very confusing because they're not, it's actually the surface of the water that you're drawing, and you're drawing the way the surface of that water moves. So there's no such physical object. You cannot touch a wave because it's a movement, correct or not?
I think you're correct there. Yeah, I mean, visualizing electromagnetic waves is tough. You know, we draw them, you know, as a sine wave or whatever on a piece of paper, but that really doesn't depict how they work quite. What all that's doing is it's graphing the, you know, the change in voltage over time or something. But in terms of a physical rendering of it, that it's really quite different.
But you will have some current and voltage distribution along these 2 meter wires. Let's say you have an electromagnetic field with the correct wavelength, which is in resonance with the 2 meters of the wire, and you will get a current flowing in the wire. At the end of the wire, there cannot be any current flow, so therefore you will only have a high voltage at the ends. And because of this sinusoidal shape, you will also have high voltage in the middle. And about quarter of the wave from each end, you will have points where you have a high current in the wire, because the wave resonates in this 2 meter wires like in a resonant circuit.
Okay, so in the center and on the ends, that's like where the kids are holding the hose pipe as it goes up and down. Yeah, I don't know if you...
Yeah.
Okay. So therefore, there's nothing happening there. What did you say was detectable? Voltage?
Yeah, there where you will have high voltage, and where you have the hose going up and down is the points where you have the high current.
Okay, now I'm confused because I'm thinking of VI over R and stuff like that. Truncate silence probably won't do justice to the way that I'm going silent here thinking about this concept. So the center bit between the so 3/4 of the way up and the quarter way up, that's where the highest amplitude is.
The highest current in the wire.
Sorry, highest current. So
and the lowest voltage, and the voltage will increase to the ends and to the middle.
Okay, but then when somebody else is transmitting, and that signal comes along through the ether, that induces a varying current, quarter of the way up and 3/4 of the way up. Would that be correct?
Yes.
I agree.
And does that affect then the voltage as well at the ends?
Yeah, the strength of the signal will influence the amplitude you see at the lowest points.
So therefore, because you plug into this as, so you're measuring the voltage difference, is that correct? Or are you measuring the amplitude? Because we need to convert it. So now something is changing. The voltage and current along that antenna or piece of wire is changing. So therefore, if you're able to detect that, you're able to detect the signal.
Yeah, and that's why you have to pay attention how you feed or couple your feed line, your cable to the antenna. For example, at the low impedance point where you have the currents, you can have a low use a coaxial cable and some connection point. And if you have a high impedance cable which can be connected at the end where you have a high voltage and low current, and I can't really explain it right now.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That I think is too complicated for the basic concept that I'm trying to get, which is just understanding there's a signal, it induces a change in current and a change in voltage. And which one do you check for? Do you check for the voltage or do you check for the current or both in a radio, in a receiver?
I'm not exactly sure how to answer that.
Yeah, because now we got a piece of wire outside, and in that wire, it's 2 meters. And you've just told me that in the middle of that 2 meters, there's a voltage induced, detectable, which varies with the strength of the incoming signal. And 3/4 of the way up and 1/4 way up, there's a variation in current. So therefore, okay, that's lovely. Now how do I take that in and then run it through amplifiers and then run it into a speaker and hear something coming out in the old classic crystal radio type thing? Bet you this is the last time I get invited to the round table.
No. Okay, so let's assume we have a parallel tuned circuit with a coil and the capacitor at the correct frequency, and a parallel tuned circuit is high impedance in, at the resonance point.
What does that mean? What does high impedance mean?
Yeah, so it has a high voltage, a high resistance at the point where it's resonant the circuit. If you use a series resonance circuit where you have the coil and the capacitor in series in a signal path, it's low impedance, so it conducts at that frequency of resonance at the best. So if you want to filter a signal, if you put a series resistance in line with your signal, you will get the best signal throughput at the resonance frequency of the tuned circuit. And if you put a parallel circuit between signal and ground, let's say, you get the lowest signal attenuation at the resonance point where this tuned circuit is high impedance and will not conduct and will not short circuit the signal. Let's assume we have this high impedance circuit, and yep. we can take the upper point at the of the tuned circuit and connect a wire, half wave, full wave length wire, which we learned is high impedance at the end because we have the high voltage there,
yeah,
which perfectly matches the high impedance of the parallel tuned circuit.
Okay.
Then we can use, for example, a tap where we make a connection at some point of the tuned circuit of the coil where we take out our voltage, which builds across the coil, and then we put it into some rectifying diode or crystal detector, which will then just produce an output voltage depending on the amplitude of the radio frequency that's received from the antenna and filtered by the tuned circuit.
Okay, I'm with you. So this radio wave that's been coming to the wire, it has come in and you filtered it out. So you're then having something else detect a voltage, or not a voltage change, produce a voltage change proportional to what it has detected on the antenna.
Yes. So proportional to the strength of the incoming signal, you get this voltage across the some point of or the full tuned circuit.
So in as an example of the kids, they have a big 2 meter hose pipe that they're wobbling up and down, and now inside you've got a 2 centimeter piece of string that you're wobbling up and down. But if you look at it, you can still see the same shapes appearing on both hose pipe and a piece of string, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. I think if we say the tuned circuit is the form factor reduction with the small string, then this could match as an analogy.
Okay, so if they're going like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, you will see 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 on the processed side, I guess. Okay, so you're carrying the signal through is all I'm saying. Probably everybody's hitting their head against the desk going, why isn't he getting this yet? Okay.
Yeah, or about my our explanations. So please join in next time and correct this.
Exactly. Hey, you're doing a better job than I do on this. But you know, the other thing I suppose we talk about here at some point is, you know, this signal that we're receiving is probably not just a carrier wave. It's a carrier wave that has been modulated with some form of information. And so, you know, going through that diode, like you talked about after the tuned circuit, you go through that diode. What you really want to get out of that is you want to get rid of the carrier frequency and get a voltage fluctuation that matches what the original information signal was that was modulated on that. And I think that's where the diode comes in play is part of the demodulation of that. Am I correct?
Yeah, exactly. So if assume the amplitude of the incoming RF signal varies slowly, in quotes, slowly as in audio frequency timing, and then you can rectify the RF, the radio frequency signal, and after the rectification, you get a jumping voltage with the changes in amplitude similar to in accordance with the changes of the amplitude of the radio frequency signal.
And okay, you put that.
Yep.
Sorry, go on. No.
And if you put a capacitor there, that will charge up and discharge slowly in the gaps where you have the wave going down, you can recreate your modulating audio signal, assuming amplitude modulation.
Okay, so but in my example of the kids just throwing the hose pipe or skipping rope, I guess would be better. Let's call it a skipping rope. They're skipping rope, where it would be. That would be more CW, the old spark gap type stuff, where...
Yeah, it will be a constant signal, constant carrier.
And then there's nothing. It's the fact is that it is just you have a signal, then you have no signal. There's no carrier wave or anything. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, when you're talking about CW, Morse code type stuff, You have a carrier for a bit, and then you don't have a carrier. Then you have a carrier for a bit, and then you don't.
And there's just very simple. It's either there, you detect it, or you don't. And you're just counting the ones and equivalent to ones and zeros going down the wire at that point.
Yeah, I mean it's dots and dashes. You have a short amount of carrier, and then nothing. Then maybe a longer amount of carrier to represent a dash. And then nothing, and so on, and it's the combination of the dots and dashes that carry the information.
So then, on top of that, as a neat way to transmit the signal, you have this carrier wave concept, where you send out a strong signal that goes up and down and up and down at a known frequency, or amplitude, or both.
If you modulate amplitude, modulate an audio tone or something, for a Morse code, you just turn on and off the carrier, and you will not hear a tone by just demodulating this carrier.
But I'm talking about, say, the AM type radio. You need one signal all the time broadcasting. And then on top of that little signal, you have wiggles. Forgive my technical description here. You have a big signal that goes woo, woo, woo. And inside that signal, you've got woo, 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 woo. Am I correct here?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I'm so embarrassed that I've done
no,
that.
No, that's exactly what it is. The first is the much higher frequency, and the little wiggles are the lower frequency, and then that's exactly how amplitude modulation works.
So the little ones are the lower frequency. I thought they would be higher because they happen more often.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering too. If you got the big and little backwards there, I mean, basically your carrier frequency is going to be the high frequency, and then that's going to change at a lower or audio frequency. And so to a certain extent, the little wiggles are, if you want to say it, is your carrier frequency. And then that carrier is going to modulate or change over some lower audio frequency.
Okay. So basically the original thing was Morse code. You turn something on, you turn it off. That wasn't very useful. So then they came up with, you turn it on for a little bit, you turn it on for a little bit more, and then you've got a dash and a dot. And then you have to look up tables, but that wasn't very useful, I guess, when people wanted to talk. So then all these other...
It's a hell of a lot useful.
No, I get that. Okay, don't attack me. Yes, I get it. But for people wanted speech to be able to transmit speech, yes.
Yeah, right, sure.
So whatever system you come up with on one side, whatever hack you come up with to carry the information, you need to, on your receiver, dehackify it. So if you use frequency modulation on one side, you need to use frequency demodulation on the other side. Correct?
Yep, that's right.
And then if you decide, well, I'm only going to do single sideband, then you need to be aware of that on the receive side. So every trick that you do, you need to be aware of what the trick is that's happening. Okay. So if people understand the concept of turning it on, turning it off, what would be the next step would be amplitude modulation, I think, is probably the easiest. Is it?
Yeah, I think that was probably developed first.
I'm just going to go to the wiki page for this, actually.
Yeah, the point is demodulation for amplitude modulation is as simple as just rectifying it with one diode or a crystal detector. And I think that's why the system was used first.
Okay, so I'm looking at there's a very good animated GIF or something on the Wikipedia article if you go to amplitude modulation. And what it's got at the top is basically a signal that goes up and down and up and down. Then underneath that, you have the same shape, only for the down bit, you're wiggling a little bit. So you have the shape there, but there are lots of I wonder, could I put this through, convert this to some sort of audio? Like, is the main signal. I'm so embarrassed at doing this, but okay.
Yeah, I hear what you're trying to do there. Okay. That's kind of right. That's sort of right, yeah.
Right, so
but it really sounds more like a frequency modulation.
Well, the frequency modulation is that's frequency modulation. But the idea is you're carrying the same signal in a different way. So if you want to get the original signal back, you need to undo whatever it is you've done.
If you really wanted to using your little audio thing there for amplitude modulation, which you shouldn't be necessarily changing pitch, you should be changing volume. So your carrier frequency is getting louder and softer, basically.
It's like,
whereas changing in pitch is more of an FM thing.
Someone should do a show about amplitude modulation using a 1 kilohertz carrier and a 2 hertz modulation signal. And
yeah, somebody could do that.
This could be audio.
That would be a nice description on the audio. But essentially, so I now understand what you mean about the on amplitude. You have a higher signal. Because the main signal is actually slower. The amplitude of the smaller signal varies, and the frequency of it is a lot faster as well. But it seems to be constant, though.
Yes.
Well, the signal itself that I'm seeing going past, and if you're looking at the Wikipedia page in red, there's a signal that goes, if you ever saw the the seismographs that goes over and back, and then when there's an earthquake, you know, it's scrolling across a piece of paper, and it's very much like that. The wave goes over and back, and then goes a little less, and then over and back a lot, and a little less, and over and back a lot, and a little less. But the moving of the hand is constant between the. So what am I seeing here, actually? Which is the carrier wave?
So the carrier wave is the red one, and the distance between zero crossings, if you think about the zero line in the middle, the frequency will stay constant, the distance between crossing this zero line, independent of the amplitude, but the frequency of this carrier wave will be constant.
So it always crosses the center line at exactly the same time. So it's always going out at the same. So it adjusts the power, is it, then, to carry the other signal?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So it's a bit like you said with the volume. It's quiet, then it's loud, then it's quiet, then it's loud. Okay, I get that. That is actually more difficult to understand than frequency modulation, although you wouldn't think so. Okay, guys, I'm thoroughly impressed. And then all the other modes and everything else are just basically more efficient variations on this. Why send a carrier down when we don't have to? Let's only send half of it when we can get away with that.
Yeah, and then when you get into actually sending data as opposed to like digital data as opposed to audio, you get into some really interesting modulations that they've figured out ways to, you know, send digital information and as opposed to just audio too.
Yeah, QAM and all the rest, and 256 QAM we use quite a lot of work, obviously, because we're a cable company. Well, I get that.
Yep.
I get that.
So QAM, so is quadrature amplitude modulation, where you change the amplitude and the
phase shift
in the phase of a signal in reference to some other signal.
And there is no way I'm going to be able to explain that with sound effects, to be honest. But a constellation diagram does.
Yeah, I'd
does
like to hear
help.
That.
Yeah, exactly. But if somebody could actually, somebody who that's a show right there. If somebody can take the amplitude modulation GIF whatever it is, animated GIF there, and convert that into some sort of signal, I would just like to hear that. Okay, anything else? How long have we been going for is the question.
I've been recording for about an hour, but I started before we really started, so I don't know.
I think I have enough to be thinking about, at least for the coming period of time. I would probably want to look at some of the books and stuff. What I've been trying to do actually has been get in touch with some people who produce a book, and there's a guy in Ireland for the Irish exam, which is very similar to an English one, and he has produced a book that's free for non-thingy use, but I haven't been able to get in touch with him to see if he'd release it under the Creative Commons CC by SA NC even, and then we could all work off that.
Okay, and the other thing is you had mentioned earlier the question pool for the US tests. Those are those are public domain, and so that's a good idea. Next time we could maybe, you know, pick out a dozen or two dozen of those questions and just kind of get a feel for what they are and what kind of things you have to know.
They're all in different sections, aren't they? Like there's in the Netherlands, you're asked, like, there's always a question on resistor codes and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you get those?
Yeah, that's the same way here. The questions are divided into categories, and, like, a given test will contain, you know, say, one or two questions from this section, one or two questions from that section, and so on.
Okay, yeah. Good. If somebody wanted to do, like, the resistor color codes, why they're there, what a resistor is, basically, and why it goes from black to white and the different mnemonics to remember them. That would be awesome. So cool. You have homework.
All right. Well, hey, thank you, Ken, for joining this discussion. It definitely expands our...
appreciation for noobs.
Well, it expands our mind here a little bit, because, you know, some of the stuff we take for granted and you know, having to try to explain it is a little bit tricky at times, but it's good to be reminded of that. I noticed that K5TUX is unmuted and still on here. Do you have anything you want to add to the discussion at this point there, Russ?
Well, unfortunately, I came in a bit late, so I'm not sure I can contribute a whole lot. I think my UTC calculation was off by an hour.
All right. Well, hey, it's good to have you in there at least. And as we say in a net, we'll put you in there for the count. And maybe next time it'll work out better for you to participate in the discussion too. Anything else anybody else wants to say before we wrap this up?
Yeah, sure. I want to congratulate to your today's show. It's fantastic.
I fear I embarrassed myself publicly, but hey. I do it so you don't have to.
No, I was talking about Steve's What's in My Ham Shack episode, which was aired today.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you.
No, I haven't listened to it yet because I listened to it in the following morning.
Yeah, kind of interesting timing there. So, see what you think about that. And if there's any other ham radio operators listening that would like to do a show on that series, I think that'd be pretty cool too.
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Steve. Thanks very much for everybody for coming up and doing these shows.
Yeah, and we could use any number of participants. Please just join and correct us and help us with explaining stuff to Ken and the others. And the next recording is at least planned for 15th November, about the same time, 18 UTC. Or if someone needs another time, we can wiggle this a little bit.
All right. Well, that sounds good. I guess we'll go ahead and wrap this up then. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of Hacker Public Radio.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.